It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beth Voorhees. Tree doctors are working to save hemlock trees from succumbing to an invasive pest.
What we're doing now is pressurizing the tree IV so that whenever we open the valves of those IV injectors, there's pressure behind it pushing that insecticide into the tree.
From Preston County, the story coming up on this West Virginia morning. Kanawha County residents got a better understanding of how the January 9th chemical spill affected the community as results from a scientific survey were released last night. Those results show some surprising numbers when it comes to how people found out about the do not use water ban, if they ignored instructions, and how the spill itself affected not just their health, but also their wallets. Ashton Mara has more.
The Kanawha Charleston Health Department and the University of Charleston teamed up to conduct the phone survey over the course of 5 days in early April, almost 90 days after the spill occurred. Before results were even discussed, two prominent community members stood to say a few words. The first, Charleston Mayor Danny Jones.
I don't speak for anybody but myself. But my life changed January 9th. I know that we have a perception problem, and I know that there's going to be some really valuable information shared with us.
Jones followed by Brenda Isaacs, president of the County Board of Health.
Suddenly, in that one evening, our perception of what comes out of our taps was forever changed.
Notice a pattern? Perception is exactly what Dr. David Lateef with the University of Charleston School of Pharmacy says the survey was about, narrowing down how the public felt about four factors: the physical, economic, and psychosocial impacts, and the quality of communication. Participants were chosen at random from a database of Kanawha County residents' phone numbers, 4,000 of which were landlines, another 2,000 were cell phones. Factoring in things like ineligibility and refusal to participate, there were 499 respondents at a response rate of almost 60%, a number Lateef says is usually closer to 25 or 30% in most surveys. Both Lateef and Dr. Raul Gupta, executive director of the county health department, stress their results are only preliminary. Analysis took place over about a month's time, and a lack of funding is preventing them from delving deeper into their results. But just the same, the two were prepared to present some findings. Some of the most interesting? Of those surveyed, 55% found out about the do-not-use ban on tap water from local television and radio, just 5% from social media. While the order was in place, some 23% said they continued to use the water, a majority of which was to bathe or wash hands, but about 37% of that amount said they were still drinking it. About 31% of respondents reported a member of their household experienced some kind of illness they believed to be related to the contaminated water. But only 1 in 4 reported seeking medical treatment for the illness. Even then, a large majority sought treatment through outpatient services, like their primary care physician or urgent care centers. A majority of respondents also reported increased feelings of worry, stress, anger, and depression during the do-not-use ban, and about half of those surveyed still believe the water is not safe to drink. When it comes to trustworthiness, local governments fared the best, with 25% of respondents giving them an A rating. 18% gave local officials a failing grade, which was by far the smallest amount of Fs. The prize for least trustworthy went to West Virginia American Water, with 31% of respondents handing the company an F grading. But there are some limitations to the survey itself. For instance, 43% of participants, almost half of the total number, were over the age of 65. Remember that number of only 5% who said they found out through social media? The 65-plus group is the least likely to participate in social media programs like Facebook and Twitter. So what if the age distribution had been different? Would those numbers have changed? Gupta says that's one question in a whole list of those he wishes he could answer. But this study is supposed to be seen as a base for future research to be conducted. Research the health department doesn't have the money to conduct.
The reality of the situation is we continue to apply for grants, and we've gotten turned down, for example, twice from the National Science Foundation. And so it's you know, I would love to say, yeah, there's millions of dollars coming this way, and everybody's working to get those. But unfortunately, we haven't found those millions of dollars. We're doing the best we can with what we have, local resources.
Even without the funding to further analyze, Gupta says there are still lessons to be learned.
If we take away from here it was just a trust factor or a communication factor, I think it'd be a mistake. We're not the best at responding to these kind of things, not as a community, not as a state, not perhaps as a nation. What do we need to do to get better at this? Anthrax, 9/11, we weren't prepared, and there was a lot of problems. CDC was not prepared. Local health departments and state health departments were not prepared. In the last, 13 years since then, or 12 and a half or so, a lot has been accomplished because we found a deficiency. And I think this is sort of a, as I said, it's sort of a red herring to tell the nation we're not prepared.
Gupta says there are a few minor studies being conducted on the spill, but he hopes to see that increase so we can learn all we can from the incident. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
And the company at the center of the chemical spill is returning to bankruptcy court today. Several motions by Freedom Industries will be heard this afternoon at the federal courthouse in Charleston. The company has asked a judge for approval to pay almost $2 million for work completed by various lawyers and consultants. A subsequent court filing proposes ways to reduce those costs. Freedom also wants to sell property and chemicals at its secondary site to a company tied to its former executives. Judge Ronald Pearson has expressed concerns about that deal. A competition on Concord University's campus challenged folks into walking more than 42 million steps, the equivalent of going across the United States almost 6.5 times. The Spring Wellness Walking Challenge was organized by students, faculty, and staff as a way to encourage more activity and better wellness on campus. Jessica Lilly reports.
According to a report from the United Health Foundation, West Virginia has the second highest rate of physical inactivity at 31% of the adult population. 450,000 adults are physically inactive in the state. Since 1990, the report says the percentage of the population that's obese increased from 15 to almost 34%. That's one reason why this study ranks West Virginia 46th overall for health. In West Virginia, the bottom 10 counties are in southern West Virginia. But folks at Concord University are working to do something about it. The Wellness Committee at Concord, as well as the Student Human Performance Organization, is hoping to encourage better health on campus and throughout the region, one step at a time. Committee member and assistant professor of human performance, Wes Mateer, was co-coordinator of the first Spring Wellness Walking Challenge.
Whether that be knowledge, physical health, mental health, just looking at avenues to increase the knowledge across campus and increase participation and increase the wellness of everyone, including faculty, staff, and students.
The Wellness Committee worked with students to initiate the walking challenge. Groups of four competed in two categories, students and faculty staff. Most of the students that helped organize the event are in one of the undergraduate human performance programs.
A lot of the students that were involved were health and physical education majors, and most of the times when they go into their own school systems, they are going to be the ones required to design a health program for their schools or an activity program, or they're going to be looked to in most cases, and this helps to give them some of the experience and things to think about that they could use when they get out into the real world.
Students helped with the development of how to promote the initiative with flyers, hosted sign-up tables, and handed out the pedometers. The teams counted their steps for 6 weeks, and whatever team took the most steps won prizes.
I feel more active.
Political science major Jordan Adkins was on the student-winning team. He says he was recruited by his girlfriend to participate.
It actually turned out to be a lot of fun and really shows you how many steps you take in a day. It's really surprising.
Adkins is originally from Wyoming County, which ranked next to last in the state, behind McDowell for health. With limited sidewalks and community fitness centers, Adkins says most of the physical activity opportunities in his home county come through organized sports.
I lived in the middle of nowhere, so you can go outside and walk in the mountains, but other than that, organized sports. When I'm at home, you know, I can sit in my room and not do anything because, I mean, there's nothing to do. It doesn't, there's nothing there to encourage me to go outside and run, walk, whatever. I think it's more of just a problem of isolation than anything.
For Atkins, it was the encouragement from his girlfriend and teammates that helped him increase his steps by 2,000 to 3,000 each week. Mateer says the Wellness Committee is now looking into building walking trails in Athens to branch out into the community.
One way to help out is to start small, start in a community where you have access. And we have access to the community here at Concord, and that are the school at least, and trying to improve it across the campus. So hopefully they can take some of the things that they may have learned and take them back to their own communities or families or friends.
Mateer also says the walking challenge is a small step to tackling a big challenge. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly, walking in Athens.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:41. Becoming partly sunny today, there's a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 80s to near 90 degrees. That chance of rain and thunderstorms continues overnight with lows in the 60s. Rain likely with a chance of thunderstorms tomorrow. Highs in the 70s and 80s. Rain and thunderstorms are likely on Thursday. It'll be cooler with temperatures reaching the 60s and 70s.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit wvdrs.org for employer services.
For the past several decades, hemlock trees across the East Coast have become home to an invasive insect that's leaving their host trees dead in the ground. Efforts to manage the blight continue. Glynis Board met up with some on the front of that fight deep in a Preston County forest and brings us this report.
So we're at Cranesville Swamp in Preston County, West Virginia. And this is a place that's pretty well known by people that are nature lovers, birders, botanists, things like that.
Mike Powell, kind of stewardship manager for the Nature Conservancy, explains that the swamp is kind of a natural relic left over from the last ice age some 15,000 years ago. It's preserved in what's called a frost pocket, where because of the elevation, the level of precipitation, climatic conditions, and a couple of other key factors, a very unique ecology exists. Today, it's home to rare snails, artesian wells, carnivorous plants, and a bunch of hemlock trees. Hemlock trees are what's known as a keystone species, meaning they are fundamental players in the forest ecologies where they grow, critical to the mountain water systems that they hug. Those that live in the eastern United States are sick and dying. Humans inadvertently introduced a tiny parasitic insect here called a hemlock woolly adelgid, which is native to hemlock trees in Japan. Since they were introduced in 1950, slowly but surely, tens of thousands of these evergreens across the East Coast are already dead.
If you're in Blackwater Canyon, looking down into the canyon, you can see hundreds or thousands of dead hemlock in the canyon. And hemlock in the eastern part of the state is largely dead on the other side of the Allegheny Front. There's pockets of good-looking trees here and there, but like Shenandoah National Park is believed to be almost hemlock-free at this point because all the hemlock there have died over time.
That's Tim Toman, forest entomologist with the West Virginia Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, the hemlock, the way it shades the forest or, you know, the area that it's in all year round, since they have their needles all year, they create a shaded environment underneath them. And in many areas of the state, it's growing over cold, high mountain streams, so it helps keep those streams cold. And in here, it's shading the forest. So when you come into parts of Cranesville and it's, you know, you've got big pockets of almost solid hemlock, yeah, when you lose that, it would definitely have a major impact.
The hemlocks grow 60 to 100 feet tall. And if you look at the underside of their needles, you can identify them by the white lines you see there. And if while you're looking at the underside of the needles, you also see little white puffs near the base of the needles. You might be staring at little sapsuckers that are draining the life from the tree in your hands.
I had heard that, when they insert themselves into the tree, they're effectively causing a wound that is stimulating the autoimmune response of the tree that sends energy to that wound.
Some of their close relatives are actually injecting a chemical into trees, like the balsam oleodelger that causes that gouting on the tree. Uh-huh. So I'm not sure if that's from the chemical or if that's a wound response, but...
Remarkably, in the decades we've been dealing with this whole woolly adelgid problem, we still haven't definitively figured out why or how they push the trees to death. All we can say for sure is that in 4 to 10 years, the trees succumb. Different techniques have been used to try and manage the problem, but Toman from the Department of Agriculture says this chemical pesticide is the most effective method so far. Now, there are a couple of ways to administer the pesticide. Toman and Powell and their teams of tree doctors will either bury pellets around the bottoms of the hemlock, or if there's a lot of water around, there's a more involved intervention, which requires a tree IV.
And you'll notice once we get this thing hooked up, you know, it truly has these little needle-like IV injectors that we'll put into the drill holes. And as long as the tree is taking up water right now, which it should be, you know, you'll see the insecticide quickly leave this jug and go through the tubes and eventually wind up into the tree.
So after choosing the trees that will most likely benefit from the pesticides, after measuring the trunk, taking the tree's temperature, hooking it up to an IV, and administering the pesticide, they tag the tree and move on to the next patient, tree.
What we're doing now is pressurizing the tree IV so that whenever we open the valves of those IV injectors, there's pressure behind it pushing that insecticide into the tree.
It's an involved, time-consuming, and expensive undertaking, but Mike Powell from the Nature Conservancy says it's totally worth it.
We've talked about these hemlock forests being, you know, filters for both the water we drink and the air we breathe. And, you know, not just hemlocks, but they're just one part of that more diverse forested ecosystem. And as we were talking about, you start taking away pieces of that puzzle, pieces of that forested ecosystem, and the ecosystem eventually starts to lose its functionality. It loses its ability to absorb, the chemicals in the air and the things in our water, and that, you know, has long-term implications not only for the biodiversity of the site, but also for the health of the people that are dependent upon these forests to provide those services to them.
Here at the Cranesville Swamp, which is on the border of Maryland and West Virginia, two state chapters of the Nature Conservancy, each state's Division of Agriculture, West Virginia's Division of Natural Resources, and the Forest Service have all come together to see to it that whatever can be done is being done to manage the problem. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in the Cranesville Swamp in Preston County.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Beneduccia. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.